Hello and welcome to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today, I'm taking a bit of a back seat as we're joined by Melbourne-based journalist Matt Smith. This week's program is a showcase of three innovative projects which in their own separate ways attempt to deal with the significant environmental challenges we face, and to do so in a constructive and practical manner. And Matt is here to lead the journey. So, I'll leave you in his capable hands.
It's hardly news that Australia is one of the most urbanised countries in the world. 9 out of 10 Australians live in urban areas, and chances are you are one of them. This is despite all the vast expanses of empty space we have. Now, population density places a huge pressure on our land use, and giving over land to new parks and green spaces is often way down the list of priorities. Despite this, green spaces in our cities are hugely important, not just for city-dwelling animals, but also for we humans. You might have noticed how the number of green spaces in the cities are declining. Now, one way to bring back these important spaces is to go up.
We can use the tops of buildings, which are currently not used for anything, as a way of increasing our green space. And that could be used for people, for recreation, or it could be used for biodiversity, or it could be used for other environmental benefits. So into the future, we're going to really need to think about multi-use green spaces, the street trees, the green roofs, the green walls, the stormwater attenuation, better managed parks and remnant vegetation. Really implementing that and having it working effectively and productively for our cities will be really important.
Dr. Nicholas Williams from the University of Melbourne is taking me to the roof of one of the buildings of the Burnley campus. Here, they've installed 3 rooftop gardens on the site to be used for research, education and demonstration. Join me and let's have a look at what sort of greenery can thrive on Australian roofs. Because so far, too little is known about what kind of plants actually like it up here.
There's over 200 plant species that are out here on the green roof at Burnley, and some have been more successful than others. Some, we need to be a bit careful about because they have set seed and moved into different parts of the roof. Some of the succulents haven't done as well as we thought they would. We're constantly learning about this. You also notice that there is a vegetable garden there. Some of those vegetables have been the things that have been escaping. We've had tomatoes and parsley and things like that growing up in the succulent beds, which we didn't really want. The price you pay when you get some tomatoes and strawberries, I guess. So we have learned a lot from this roof. One of the nice things about it is because it's up on the roof, it's a bit warmer than other areas of the Burnley Gardens. And so things flower up here for longer, they flower earlier. And so that's really useful for our teaching. And not just teaching about green roofs, but teaching in plants and horticulture in general. This is our demonstration green roof. We really built this to demonstrate the different types of green roofs that are available to people in Melbourne. So we have a range of different depths here of the substrate, or the specially engineered soil that the plants are growing in. And as you can see, the depth of them increases as we go further back towards the back of the green roof. On our right is irrigated green roof, and on the other side is unirrigated green roof. And so we wanted to show people, well, this is what you can do if you have water available. Say you catch water in a rainwater tank and you might pump it up here. So obviously if you've got water available, you've got a different range of plants that you can grow on a green roof compared to if you don't have water. If you don't have water in shallow substrates such as 10 centimetres or 15 centimetres deep, you really need some really tough, hardy plants such as succulents, which are going to be able to survive the extreme conditions that are found on green roofs.
So it's not only about showing as well, a lot of this is about research, isn't it, and seeing what works best and how things thrive in this kind of environment.
This roof is the result of our research. So we don't actually use this roof for our research. We do have a lot of the plants that we have trialled here. We've done experiments on them. We've worked out what lives and what dies. The species at the back there are all Australian native species, which we know can change their water use depending on how much water is available. So they're really useful plants for a green roof because green roofs act as a sponge and they absorb water. One of their main benefits is stormwater attenuation. But you want plants which, if the water is there, are going to evapotranspire and actively pump that water out of the green roof, leaving space for the next rainfall event to be captured.
The most obvious use that comes to mind for me for using a space like this is because it is here. I imagine this was empty roof before this. But what else is there? Why should we be engaging in projects like green roofs?
So, yeah, this was a bitumen roof beforehand and it got really hot. The staff room is next door, so that heat was previously radiating into the staff room. Meant we had increased air conditioning costs in the staff room. Very inhospitable. No biodiversity lived on it. And the rainwater just fell on it and went down the stormwater drains. By putting a green roof on here, we've been able to have a whole lot of benefits. It's cooler now, both on this roof and in the room below. So the green roof acts as an insulating blanket. It also acts as a sponge. So when it rains, the rainfall will be absorbed into the green roof and won't go down the stormwater system. And Melbourne Water and other water authorities around Australia are really concerned about whole lot of stormwater runoff that comes when we have rainfall events in our cities. And so we can really reduce the volume of rainwater coming off our cities by installing a whole lot of green roofs. And our research is showing a 10 centimetre green roof in Melbourne's climate can absorb between 60 and 80% of the year's rainfall. So they're really effective in Melbourne's climate, and probably the climate of most southeastern Australian cities, absorbing that rainfall and not letting that into the creeks and rivers to cause environmental problems.
The roof garden is a series of raised walkways surrounded by strategically placed native plants. The research undertaken by Nick's team shows what's possible when building green roofs in the Australian climate. Nick hopes that this sort of initiative will encourage people to make them as successful here as they have become overseas.
So green roofs are quite common in North America and Europe, particularly in Germany, where they're almost mandatory on all flat roof buildings. But in Australia, up until very recently, they have been quite rare. And that's because they often died, because we didn't know what plants grew on them, or we didn't have the right substrates. And so our research has really shown what type of substrates will work, what type of plant pellets will work on the roofs. And the ultimate goal is to be able to retrofit green roofs to a lot of our existing buildings, but also show different designs which will work on new buildings. And so as we need to adapt our cities to climate change with more intense temperatures and stronger, rarer rainfall events, we really need to think about how we're going to do that. And green infrastructure is a real key part of that. And obviously there's a lot of spare space on the roofs of our cities, and putting green roofs into them is a good way of changing the urban environment for the better.
How transplantable is something like this?
There are green roofs in the middle of the city, but obviously each green roof is specific. The a lot will depend on the weight loading that the roof can handle. And so if you don't have a lot of structural support, you're not going to be able to have a green roof, or not going to have a particularly deep green roof. And the deeper a green roof can be, the more variety of plants, the greater amount of benefit it provides. So it really does depend on the type of building that you're dealing with. But not all green roofs have to be like this, you know, accessible public spaces. Also in this building we have a biodiversity roof, which is specifically designed to provide habitat. And this is an inaccessible roof, and there's plenty of roofs in Melbourne which are inaccessible, and we can just use them for their environmental benefits, whether that's biodiversity or to improve urban hydrology, or hopefully mitigate a little bit the urban heat island effect.
One problem that you're going to encounter in a city is older buildings, a lot that are heritage listed. Are those the sort of things that can have green roofs?
Absolutely. This is a heritage listed building. So this the main building here at the Burnley campus is a heritage listed building. We had to take that into consideration when we put the green roof on, but it ticked off all the boxes. The heritage consultant said it wasn't a problem. The heritage buildings can often support green roofs better than more modern buildings because they were built more structurally sound. So there's a number of buildings at the Parkville campus of Melbourne Uni which we're investigating putting green roofs on, and these are buildings built in the 1930s and 40s. They've got concrete roofs, quite suitable. Just because you've got a heritage building doesn't mean that a green roof is incompatible.
So in the context of Australia's biodiversity, how do you see the green roof projects contributing to that?
Traditionally, people see cities as biodiversity deserts, which is not really the case, but we can still do a lot to improve urban areas for biodiversity habitat. We've had a huge variety of insects and butterflies, also different bird species. We have a pond, a small pond on the biodiversity roof, and birds use that. we are providing additional habitat, which is to a certain extent not that managed. You know, a lot of habitats in urban landscapes are manicured and always disturbed. But if we can put a biodiversity roof up, we can maybe have to go to that area two or three times a year. And so it gives us space for wildlife to inhabit. And insects in particular can pollinate flowers. The larvae can eat the plants. And so it provides a bit of an out-of-the-way area where they can provide some habitat. And we've had students looking at how much biodiversity is colonising green roofs around Melbourne. Tend to be that the green roofs lower to the ground have higher insect numbers than those higher up. But it really is about what's in the surrounding landscape again. So while they could be quite useful for increasing biodiversity, it's also about what's in the surrounding landscape, and we need to maintain our green spaces and our remnant habitats in the urban landscapes more generally. Green roofs will not be a replacement for natural habitats, but they can be a really good supplement for them, providing additional habitat to maybe increase species numbers.
That's Dr. Nicholas Williams, one of the leaders of the Green Infrastructure Research Group at the University of Melbourne. And we'll leave him to get his strawberries back under control. I'd now like to take you to a farm where the process of irrigation is about to take a step towards a greener and quieter future. What you're now hearing is a water pump which irrigates crops. It uses diesel as fuel, and well, it's quite noisy. But this noise could soon become a thing of the past. Dr. Abhijit Date at RMIT University in Melbourne, together with researchers at the University of Pune in India, have been working on a groundbreaking new pump technology. A simple, cheap system that can pump water for irrigation, using an engine to operate on solar or thermal energy, not on diesel or electricity. And the way it does that is through the wonder of steam.
Now, the system in front of us, this is called thermal power pump. And since 2012, I've been working on this particular machine. It started from an idea of using isothermal expansion. Isothermal expansion means expansion of fluid at constant temperature. How to use that process to get some useful work out of it. Till now, there has not been any machine developed or any thermodynamic process which has been developed which could utilize very low temperature heat and get some useful work out of it.
Just to be clear, the pump's engine is driven by steam produced from boiling water. The energy to power the engine comes from any low temperature heat source, be it geothermal or waste heat from another source, say home heating. Once it's operating, the machine pumps water from a bore or above ground water supply by means of a piston action. Abhijit Date explains how.
This hot water urn which you see here, because this is a lab environment, we are using that hot water urn to simulate solar hot water system. So imagine we have got a solar hot water system which is heating water up to 80 degrees Celsius or 70 degrees Celsius. That's our heat source. Literally as simple as you're boiling a liquid, forming vapor, and then condensing that vapor, forming back liquid, and doing that on a cyclic form. So boiling, condensing, and you're making the piston move.
Now, what's interesting about this new prototype pumping machine is in its very simplicity. Because it's simple and cheap to make, and because it runs on renewable energy, not diesel or electricity, it will be ideal for remote regions and developing nations, hence the involvement of Pune University. The pump is still in its prototype phase, so at the moment it's made from a small urn and looks like something you could make a cup of tea with. But Dr. Date is confident that once it's scaled up, it'll be able to deal with a large volume of water and be much more effective.
Talking big picture, broad, globally, almost 40% of our primary energy consumption throughout the world is wasted in form of low temperature heat, waste heat. So imagine if one could recover all of that 40% of heat and use that heat to do something useful, like to desalinate water, to pump water. It would be an immediate effect on the energy consumption of the world, and it's going to have a bigger impact on global CO2 emissions, because all that 100% primary energy is coming from fossil fuels. So it's as good as you're reducing the fossil fuel consumption about 10% of the total. by separating the expansion stroke from the cooling side or from the heat sink, what I've been able to achieve is at a very low temperature differences, I could operate this particular machine. So, for example, if I have got heat source at about 50 degrees Celsius and heat sink at about 40 degrees Celsius, this machine can still operate. Heat engines, mechanical heat engines, they stop operating if the temperature differences go below 20 degrees between hot and cold, whereas this one can still operate.
So what are the other benefits? So it's going to be able to function at temperature better.
So this could be used as an irrigation or agricultural water pump where the only input could be solar thermal, it could be geothermal, it could be waste heat from a chimney in a house, like a fireplace. It could be burning biomass on the farm, like a vineyard and grape prunings, which usually farmers, they would just burn it because they want to get rid of it. And there's a lot of energy in there. That heat could be used to drive this pump.
And at the moment, those sort of uses are only being driven by diesel, I suppose,
mostly.
Yes, that's
right. At present, for irrigation, where the farms are off-grid, there is either a diesel pump or petrol-driven water pumps. There are applications where people are using solar photovoltaic panels, solar PV panels, to drive these pumps. But solar PV panels are very weather-dependent. Imagine you have got a solar hot water system where what is heated, that hot water is stored in an insulated tank. That hot water could be used to run this solar thermal pump. Now, there's nothing environmentally bad about water itself. So storing solar heat in water is most environmentally friendly. At the same time, it's very highly efficient. Solar PV panels, they have efficiency around 12% commercially available, whereas solar hot water systems, they can go up to 40-45%. At lower temperatures, they can go up to 65-70% efficiencies. So solar energy stored in hot water form.
So is there a reason why this couldn't be used further than on farms and remote areas like that? Because this sounds like, you know, the ideal sort of technology that you'd want to push as far as possible.
Yeah, definitely. That's the main aim of conducting this particular project. Right now, we are still at very early stage of development. Now, what you see in front of you is still a lab scale model. The whole capacity of the thermal pump here is 2 liters per stroke. So it can only deliver 2 liters of volume of water every stroke. It's a very slow-moving pump. We need to optimize it. Then the next application, what we are trying to investigate, is using this thermal water pump to drive a reverse osmosis desalination system. So, for example, northern part of Victoria, northwest, which is salt-affected, and similar to northern South Australia is salt-affected regions. So where groundwater is there, but it's very salty. You can't use it for human consumption, not for cattle consumption, definitely not for farming. Mm. And there's plenty of sun. So there you could use this pump with solar thermal heat, pressurize salt water, and pass it through a reverse osmosis membrane. And what you get out is desalinated water as one of the products, which is useful product, and highly concentrated brine as one of the waste products. Application of these pumps would be very ideal with salt manufacturing business. So the waste product is a very valuable raw material for salt manufacturer, whereas fresh water could be used for the industry or for the local community, for drinking or agricultural or whatever purposes they want.
You say that this is a later type prototype. How big does it have to be for it to be an effective machine for what you've intended?
Our next step, what we are planning, going from 2 litres volume per stroke to 10 litres volume per stroke, and I think anything beyond 10 litres of volume per stroke would be very reasonable for individual kind of household applications, small property on the farm where 4 or 5 people are living, big enough system for a small family. If you want to think for a big town, so similar to that, you could have 6-cylinder or 10-cylinder thermal water pumps where half of the pump cylinder is active, half are doing the suction stroke, where sucking the water from the ground, and half of them are delivering the water to the destination.
Dr. Abhijit Date, a lecturer from the School of Aerospace, Mechanical and Manufacturing Engineering at RMIT University. And once again, his new pump will not only be cleaner and cheaper to run, it will also desalinate the water it pumps at the same time. And on top of that, it's also much quieter. Another win for the environment. You're listening to Future Tense. I'm Matt Smith. And today we're looking at three research initiatives around the environment and sustainability. Our final story has a bit of a twist. It involves not just a new approach to land and wildlife management, but at the same time, a reassessment of an old approach that not so long ago seemed like the way forward. It involves a piece of simple technology that stretches from tropical Queensland, does a dogleg around the New South Wales border, trails down through South Australia, and ends on a forlorn cliff face overlooking the Great Australian Bight. I'm talking about the dingo fence. Now, you might be familiar with the rabbit-proof fence, an ambitious barrier that was designed to keep rabbits and other pests out of Western Australia pastoral lands. But there's an older similar concept in Eastern Australia, and it's aimed at dingoes. The two habitats it separates couldn't be more different, explains Dr. Ewan Ritchie of Deakin University.
When you see the area, it's like two universes. So inside the fence, there's very large numbers of kangaroos and often less vegetation. And outside the fence, there's less kangaroos and more vegetation. And of course, that's potentially associated with dingoes. That's what research suggests. So where you have dingoes, you have less herbivores in particular. Where you don't have these things like dingoes, then you have a lot more herbivores and a lot less vegetation. And the other thing, of course, that we do also have, where you have less dingoes, is more cats and foxes.
Like the rabbit-proof fence, the dingo barrier fence is aimed at keeping dingoes out of the fertile farmlands of lower eastern Australia. It costs roughly $10 million a year to maintain, so it's not cheap, and Ewan Ritchie is one of a number of researchers who believe that the fence isn't cost-effective. In fact, he says it's doing more harm than good.
I think it's unfair to criticise decisions that were made in the past, particularly when we didn't have very much information about the important role of dingoes in the Australian landscape. But I think if we were to look at it now and ask the question, is the dingo barrier fence ecologically responsible and is it sustainable? The answer would be no. We know that with dingoes being absent from ecosystems, we have more cats, we have more foxes, we have too many kangaroos, we often have feral goats, pigs, etc., and they all have their own impacts. What we really need to be doing now is thinking of better solutions to actually improve the conservation of biodiversity in Australia. But it also ties in with an interesting idea that's developing right around the world. So in many parts of the world, including Europe and North America, there is a real movement known as rewilding. And the idea of rewilding is to restore function back to landscapes. And what I mean by that is that if we know that wolves, as an example, do a certain thing in habitats and ecosystems, and that cannot be replaced by what humans do, then we need to actually allow wolves to move in back into areas to actually get the environment back to a condition that it once was in. The same in Europe. So things like lynx have moved back into parts of Sweden, and we've seen red fox numbers come down. So what we can start to do is actually work more with nature rather than against nature.
So the methods of the past don't always turn out to be the best solutions in hindsight. As we've heard, sometimes they simply solve one problem while creating others in turn. So according to Ewan Ritchie, the dingo fence, a symbol of sorts of the Australian farming history, needs to come down. But how do you convince farmers to change their long-held beliefs about the necessity of the fence? And not only that, how do you get them to embrace the return of the dingo to their farmlands as well? Ewan Ritchie.
So if you're a cattle grazer, an example, or a sheep grazer, and you have lots of kangaroos on your property, that means there's going to be less grass for your sheep and your cattle. So counterintuitively, actually, if you have dingoes on your property, you're more likely to have less kangaroos and actually be better off overall because there's more grass available for your livestock. Many of us would argue that the fence is not the way to go. So there's a range of solutions that are now available to us. They include things like maremmas. So they are large guardian dogs that have been used in Europe for centuries. They've been also used a similar species in Africa to protect goats against leopards. So guardian animals are a really effective solution for protecting livestock while still having native predators in the landscape at the same time. You can use small fencing to protect young animals, so things like lambs and calves when they're particularly vulnerable, but you don't need to construct a really large fence that essentially fences off a very large part of Australia, so South East Australia. We don't need to have that huge expense, and we're talking about sort of tens of millions of dollars per year to maintain that fence as well as the costs that come with that. So there's a range of solutions available. Also, giving farmers money if they have stock loss. So rather than actually paying money to maintain the fence, if farmers lose their stock to wild dog attack, we could actually give them government subsidies and actually support them in that way. So that's another solution that's also been used in other parts of the world where carnivores are in the landscape and we want to maintain those carnivores. So things like lions and leopards, we can actually give farmers money if they have stock law. So what we really need to be doing is saying that we now have good ecological information that dingoes are important in maintaining biodiversity because they control things like cats and foxes, but also keep herbivore numbers in check, so they keep kangaroo populations from becoming too high, and also suppress things like feral goat populations. But we also know, and there's been economic modelling done by scientists that shows that if you actually have dingoes on your property, you actually better off in a net sense because of the effect that they have on things like kangaroo populations.
So you co-authored a paper proposing to move part of the fence. Can you tell me about that and what the intentions of that are?
Yeah, so the idea is to move the fence currently that borders the Sturt National Park in western New South Wales, to move the fence further east to allow dingoes to move into the Sturt National Park, to essentially see when we allow dingoes to recolonise an area, such as would occur if we were to remove parts of fences or shift a fence somewhere else, what are the consequences of that? So what happens ecologically particularly? So if we allow dingoes to come back into the Sturt National Park, we would expect to see things like kangaroo populations and even in some cases emu populations, which can get quite large without predation. Are they reduced? And are there positive consequences of that? So do you see more vegetation as an example? And also, would we see things like cat and fox populations being suppressed?
I mean, assumably that is something that would work. Those other populations of animals are going to drop as a result of this. Is further experimentation and proposals needed to see how it would affect cattle populations and livestock, because there's none in the national park?
Yeah, to fully understand the consequences of allowing dingoes to come into certain areas, we'd need to conduct more experiments. Now, it's important to remember there has been a number of experiments conducted in the past where dingo populations have been controlled to see what effect that has. And we've also seen areas where we've compared areas where dingoes aren't controlled to where they are controlled. But that's quite different to allowing dingoes to move back into an area and allowing them essentially to stabilise under their own steam and then to see what happens ecologically speaking. So we would need to have a look at other areas in different parts of Australia to see if the same patterns happen in different parts of Australia, because we might have a certain response in western New South Wales in a particularly arid situation. You might see kangaroo populations come down quite significantly with dingoes, but the question is, would the same thing happen further south in Australia where it's a wetter environment, there's higher kangaroo numbers? Would we see the same sort of pattern? Would we see the same sort of pattern in northern Australia as well? So moving up towards places like far northern Queensland, if we were allowed dingoes to come into cattle grazing areas, would we see the same sort of patterns or not? So yes, we'd need to have a whole range of experiments in different parts of Australia. If we can allow dingoes to come back into habitats, we don't need to manage kangaroo populations anymore. The dingoes will do their work for free. We don't need to manage feral goats anymore. Again, the dingoes will do it for free. Same thing goes with cats and foxes. Those animals are performing really important roles that we simply cannot do ourselves. When you think about how big Australia is, and Australia, of course, is huge, it's literally impossible for us to run around all of Australia and try and shoot and poison and control cats and foxes all the time. We can't do that. But if you allow dingoes to move through landscapes, they can do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for free. So in terms of sustainability, that's by far the better solution than having more fences, more poison and more bullets.
You and Richie from Deakin University, out along the dingo fence. And that report was from Melbourne journalist Matt Smith. Now, the practice of rewilding, which Dr. Ritchie mentioned there, was the subject of a program we did on Future Tense a little while back. Rewilding is essentially the reintroducing of carnivores and other top-level animals into depleted environments in order to restore a more natural balance. That's the theory. If you're interested, we've put a link to that rewilding episode on our website, so take a listen. Thanks to co-producer Karin Zsivanovits and sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time on Future Tense, cheers.
What does one of our greatest speechwriters think about the impact of social media on political discourse?
What is happening now with the development of social media is as significant in world history and in the human condition as, say, the invention of the printing press and the development of the mass circulation newspapers. If we're dinkum about democracy, we've got to embrace it and cope with it.
That's Graham Fraudenberg on Between the Lines, online at the RN homepage.